Hello and welcome back to another PaleoCast. I'm Dave Marshall.
And I'm John Tennant.
And today we're going to be talking to Russell Garwood, an 1851 research fellow at the University of Manchester, about the Carboniferous, the land animals which were about at the time, and the techniques he uses to study these. So the first land animals came onto land sometime before 425 million years ago. These early colonisers were members of a group called the arthropods, probably early relatives of the millipedes first, followed shortly by arachnids, and then insects at some point later. Then, as now, these animals comprise the great majority of living organisms. However, early land animals, especially those from the Paleozoic era, are relatively rarely preserved as fossils. The Carboniferous period is an exception to this rule. During the late Carboniferous, there is a window in which land animals are found preserved as three-dimensional holes within the iron carbonate mineral siderite. This kind of preservation allows paleontologists to use 3D reconstruction techniques, such as high-resolution CT scanning, to investigate this unique insight into early land-based ecosystems. So joining us today is Russell Garwood. So could you just give us a little introduction about yourself, Russell?
Yeah, absolutely. I work on early land animals, and I'm currently at Manchester University and looking at some of the first creepy crawlies that came onto land. And I try and use modern techniques like X-ray microtomography, a 3D reconstruction technique, to try and better understand these early animals.
As an introduction, can you tell us about the early evolution of life onto land?
Yeah, sure thing. So life on land actually has fairly deep origins. So the kind of first well-documented evidence of terrestrial organisms, i.e. those that live on the surface of land, are about a billion years old. And they come from Scotland, a group of rocks called the Torridonian. And they were actually described by Leila Battison, who you spoke to a few episodes ago. And so those single-celled organisms kind of bumbled along for quite a long time after that. And then about 423 million years ago, we get the first body fossils of plants on land. And those kind of are the beginning of what we may think of as recognisable ecosystems on land. And they were shortly followed by arthropods. So our first kind of arthropods, which are creatures which have an exoskeleton, they molt as they grow. Things like millipedes, spiders, insects, all of those are members of this group. And the first members of the group on land were millipedes at about 425 million years old. So that was really when animal life on land kicked off. Then the first vertebrates actually only came onto land at about 385 million years ago. So we've got a very long period, about 50 million years or so, when the only life on land was in the form, or in terms of animals, was in the form of millipedes and arachnids, so spiders and their kin. And most fossils that record Paleozoic terrestrial life, so that which predates the big extinction at the end of the Permian period, so 251 million years ago, most of the fossils we have from this period from land are actually Carboniferous. So that's a time period from about 350 to 299 million years ago, and those are the fossils I work on. So we've got, during this time period, unique conditions where we get lots and lots of animals on land preserved, and they're preserved in three dimensions. So I try and use 3D techniques to look at these to better understand these early animals and how they lived in these early rainforests, we may like to think of them, or rainforest-like ecosystems. And so that's basically where I'm coming from and what I've been doing.
Right. So why do we find so few terrestrial fossils before the Carboniferous period then? Are they preserved differently somehow?
Or they're not preserved at all, I think, is the major issue there. So before the Carboniferous, we didn't have the unique circumstances, which I'll describe in a minute, which lead to terrestrial preservation. So animals on land tend to die. They'll probably fall into soil. And soil is a really, really good environment for animals to decay in. There are lots of bacteria and other animals that can actually eat their remains. And there's very little left. As a result, the majority of land fossils that we see are certainly, in terms of creepy crawlies like arthropods, are creatures which have been washed into rivers or lakes and then buried at the bottom of the sediment in that aqueous environment. So that's the major reason that we don't see many land-based fossils, is that they're purely not preserved. They decay and there's nothing left of them to be preserved in the fossil record. It's only in these exceptional circumstances, when they're buried in water, for example, that we actually get the bodies of land animals preserved.
But in these times, we actually had the same kind of rivers and lakes and the environments that you would get in the Carboniferous as well. So why is it that we don't get that kind of special preservation earlier on as well?
Actually, we don't really get the same set of circumstances that lends the Carboniferous towards preserving land animals. So it's a really unique setup in the Carboniferous that means we get lots of these land fossils. So basically the norm is what we have now, which is where things aren't preserved, where things decay away. And it's not because of the rivers and the lakes, but it's actually because of the paleogeography of the Carboniferous era, the way in which the continents were arranged, which is why we get these fossils preserved, along with a number of other different aspects of the life at the time.
So you mentioned that the arthropods in the Carboniferous were often preserved in an aquatic environment or an aquatic setting. So how is it that we're able to say that these arthropods were terrestrial, they were living on land and not in this kind of, in these rivers or lakes?
That's one of the most difficult questions to answer a lot of the time. So we can in part do it by their group or their evolutionary relationships. There are some groups which we know are almost entirely aquatic. They only live in water, especially during this time period. So an example of that would be the crustaceans, which during this time period, we don't have any evidence for the groups of crustaceans that now live on land existing back 300 million years ago. And in contrast to that, there are groups like the arachnids, so that's spiders, scorpions and their kin, which we think have actually evolved entirely on land from a single terrestrial ancestor. So we think that this group, for example, arachnids, were the earlier members of these, were the first terrestrial predators, and they've evolved entirely on land. So if we find a member of this group from the very, from their very kind of biological identity, we can say it's likely they lived on land. Also, there are a number of different ways that we can tell from their morphology, from their appearance, whether they may have lived on land or whether they may have lived in water. So obviously, if they have a means by which they can breathe air, so if they have lungs, for example, that's a really good indicator that they would be terrestrial. If they have structures like scorpions do, sensory hairs, which don't really work in water, again, it's a really good bet that they lived on land. So there are elements of their physiology, their anatomy, which can point us towards them living on land or them being aquatic creatures. But it's a very, very fuzzy line, and it's often quite hard to tell which is in fact the case.
You mentioned crustaceans, and they're a good example of animals that can live in the water and can also live on land, if you think about crabs running about. How are you able to say that an animal can be fully terrestrial opposed to just amphibious?
There is basically no way we can say that at all. So when you're looking at animals, especially modern animals, whether they're terrestrial or live in water, it's a very, very messy line. And it's basically, it always comes down to a judgment call. Think of, for example, seals, which are evolved from land animals, but they spend most of their time, or a lot of their time, swimming around. Or, for example, penguins. And the same goes for crabs. There are lots of crabs that live purely on land, or at least on the beaches, and those that live purely in the sea. And there's a whole gradation between them. So basically, with modern animals, what it comes down to, it's just a judgment call of how you want to describe it, which vocabulary you use. And so when we can't actually observe their behavior, so when we've got fossils, it's even harder to say.
So to make this transition from being an aquatic dwelling organism to living on land, what kind of biological changes have to be made?
So as you can imagine, there's quite a lot of difference between living in water and living on land where you're surrounded by air. And there are quite a lot of different changes you have to make to your physiology or the way your body works in order to be able to survive in those different environments. And there are a number of major considerations for different animals. And because I work on arthropods, I'll probably draw a lot of my examples from those, but the same also applies to vertebrates for a lot of these. So one major problem if you're a land animal is water loss. Water can be hard to come by, but it's absolutely vital. And there are a number of ways you can minimize the amount of water you lose because you don't want to dry out. And those can involve having a surface coating, so an exoskeleton in arthropods or a skin in vertebrates. Often some of the most soggy bits that lose the most water are breathing apparatus, so lungs or book lungs in the case of arachnids. And so you can actually have controlled openings to those. So for example, in a lot of millipedes and a lot of arachnids, you see things called spiracles, which are openings which allow the creature to minimize the water loss through its lungs. And a major issue is also excretion. So when animals digest protein, generally they create excess nitrogen, and that's normally liberated in the form of ammonia, which is a very toxic substance. You don't really want it in your system. If you live in the water, it's really easy just to wash that away and have it diluted. But that's not the case if you live on land. So you have to change it to something less harmful. So in vertebrates, we change it to, or certainly in mammals, we change it to urea, which is less harmful. But in arthropods, and in fact in birds, they often change it to uric acid, which is a solid substance, which means they can minimize water loss. So all of those bits of the physiology, the way the animal works, has to be changed. And that's just to adjust for water loss to make sure you don't dry out. Then there are a whole slew of other challenges. So for example, if you're living on land, you have to breathe air. So the apparatus you have for gas exchange has to change from gills to a form of lungs, or in the case of insects, trachea, which are little branching tubes that actually open directly into muscles and into the inside of the creature. And so that's another major challenge. Another thing we don't really think about, but is quite important to land animals, is reproduction. If you're living on land, you have to adjust the way you live. So some animals do this by creating spermatophores, which are like packets of sperm, which are kind of a bit more impervious to the harsh terrestrial environments. But even better than that is internal fertilization, for which you need to have a copulatory organ. So penises, for example, have evolved multiple times throughout the animal kingdom just to get over this problem that if you're living on land, yet you want to reproduce, it makes sense to fertilize internally, and having copulatory organ and copulation as a means of sexual reproduction really helps with that. And a final consideration for land animals is locomotion. So you basically have to have a skeleton or an exoskeleton to provide structural support, because air supports you less than water. That's just four or five examples, though. And there are a whole range of other problems, like temperature control, which can impact on life on land. And this actually leads to some problems in a lot of the groups. So with arthropods, for example, our ideas of arthropod evolution and relationships can actually be quite muddled. And that's because a lot of the groups have adapted to terrestrialization. So they've got a number of the same traits that they've evolved either convergently or from a common ancestor. And untangling which of those two is the case is very difficult, because there's a clear reason they would have evolved these traits. They evolved them to survive on land. So things called Malpighian tubules, that are the arthropods' equivalent of kidneys, have evolved multiple times. So have trachea, those things that allow them to breathe. All of those you see in lots and lots of groups. So actually untangling the evolutionary relationships is very difficult, and it's because all of these physiological changes have happened to allow them to survive on land. So, yeah, there's a lot.
Of all of these structures, kind of like the lungs and genitalia, and also the legs, how many of those are readily preservable in the fossil record?
So it really depends on the character. Some things, for example, the exoskeleton or the skeleton, preserves fairly well. It's hard, it's resistant to decay. And as a result, we're quite likely to see fossils of it. Other parts, such as the gills or lungs, depending on which group you're looking at, those are very, very soft and they'll decay very, very easily. So with those, it's very difficult to see them. So it really does depend on what aspect of the creature you're trying to look at for your evidence of where they lived.
I got to ask as well, what's the earliest evidence for a penis in the fossil record then?
So let me answer that question. There are three Paleozoic penises. I'm sure you're pleased to hear. The earliest one is 425 million years old, I believe, which is actually an aquatic creature. It's in a marine animal, an ostracod, so a member of the crustaceans. And that's from the Herefordshire Largostata. So that was done by Derek Civita and the Herefordshire Research Group, where they ground away a fossil. They reconstructed it from photographs of the cross sections in 3D, and lo and behold, there was a penis there that was about a third of the entire body size of the creature. So it was quite an impressive penis, let alone its age. It was just pretty awesome. And it actually got the headline in The Sun, "What an old todger." So, you know, that's pretty awesome. So that's the first fossilized penis. Then at 413 million years old, there's the first fossilized penis of a land animal. So that's found in a harvestman, a member of an arachnid group, which has a penis and internal copulation. And that's from the Rhynie Chert in Scotland. And that's also quite an impressive piece of kit, it must be said. And then there's also a Carboniferous penis, which I've just discovered on a fossil, which is very, very exciting and is absolutely wonderful. So you'll be hearing about that in the near future, I'm sure.
So in terms of like the transition from water to land, would they've had to go through like a kind of saltwater, freshwater, pure terrestrial fit, kind of a sequence, or would it have just been straight from seawater onto land?
That's a fairly fundamental question, and it's one I really wish I could answer, but I'm afraid we just don't know right now. Because I think that it's very important to realise that actually there's a hell of a lot of really fundamental questions about life on land, which we don't know the answer to because many people look at it. So we've got this issue where we don't have that many early terrestrial animals preserved because they live on land, because they don't preserve that well. So we don't have that many fossils that record this transition. As a result, we're not entirely sure what the case is. So with vertebrates, there are some creatures like Ichthyostega, which seem to be found in freshwater environments. But there are tracks of things that look like tetrapods a few million years before that, which look like they're found in marine sediments. And similarly, with most of the major arthropod groups, we actually find them in a fairly advanced form. Most of their evolution onto land occurred before the earliest body fossils. And so we can't even use the environments of the rocks those creatures are found in to say anything about the first creatures on land. So with those, all we can really do is look at later creatures. So things like wood lice have come onto land later and try and use those as to give us an idea of the path organisms may take onto land. But for most of the major arthropod groups, certainly we don't have any idea. And same with the vertebrates, the early tetrapods. At the moment, the jury is still out. So hopefully we'll be able to answer that in another two or three decades.
Could it be a case of both being applicable? Because wood lice are crustaceans, aren't they?
They are indeed.
But they tend to like damp terrestrial environments where you get fresh water, whereas crabs, also crustaceans, are also amphibious and they are in salt water.
So absolutely, with gusto, there are multiple terrestrialization events. There's one, we think, in the arachnids, though some people argue that there may be two, and the scorpions have a separate terrestrialization event to the rest of the arachnids. That's a whole can of worms we don't want to open. The crustaceans, as well as having crabs and woodlice, it turns out, on the basis of current thinking, that insects, which are a very important group, they make up something like 75% of all described living organisms, and it turns out that at the moment we think those are actually just highly derived crustaceans. So in terms of crustaceans, there have been at least three terrestrialization events. In terms of the millipedes and the centipedes, there was at least one there. And so we're probably looking at a whole range of different ways to come onto land. As you say, it kind of makes sense that things will come onto land, they'll start living in humid environments, and then gradually adapt towards being more adept at going into drier environments. But there were probably multiple paths for multiple different groups, and those have occurred over a fairly large space of time. So it really is very hard to tie down the details.
So if we can bring it back to the Carboniferous period in which you're working, can you tell us what you can see in the geology?
Absolutely. So what we think was happening during the Carboniferous period is that we had two supercontinents that were coming together in a collision. It's a collision we call the Variscan Orogeny. And as a result of this collision, Pangaea was formed. So Pangaea is made up of these two continents that existed during this time. The northern one is called Laurasia, and the southern one is called Gondwana. And as they collide, Pangaea starts to build, and around the equator there's a massive mountain chain that's the equivalent of the Himalayas, for example, today, which gradually builds as these two continents collide. You have, as a result, lots and lots of shallow seas around the equator, lots of continental shelf areas, so these kind of nice shallow bits where there can be lots of thick creatures living on there. And that's pretty much what we think was happening. And what was really neat about this is because in this equatorial zone, you had equatorial weather. It made it ideal for the formation of what we may think of as the rainforest ecosystems. So trees had evolved in the Devonian, and by this point, they were becoming nice, lush swathes of forest with lots of different layers and some fairly complex ecosystems living in there in these continents.
So, in episode 4, we visited the fossil forest of Gilboa from the Devonian. Has plant life changed much since then?
So, actually, life was fairly similar at this point to the plant life we saw in the Devonian. So, trees had got taller. They tended to use a lot more lignin, this strong structural component they use in their bark, especially during this period, to grow into very, very tall trees. And we've got a multi-layered canopy. However, the major groups of plants are largely the same. So you have things like lycopsids, which don't really have any modern equivalent, but they're best thought of as tree ferns. But the major story that we're seeing from the Devonian and then carrying on through the Carboniferous is just a continuing change in their reproductive strategy. So they're moving, plants are moving from cloning to spores and pollen to seeds and ovules. And so that is allowing vegetation to thrive in the more changing environmental conditions. But many of the groups and many of the organisms themselves are actually fairly similar in their morphology and their relationships throughout these two time periods.
425 million years ago, when these first arthropods came onto land, how long did it take for other groups of organisms to kind of realise it was an awesome idea and join them?
About 40 or 50 million years. So the earliest tetrapod trackways are around 385 million years ago. And then body fossils of things, creatures which look like they could have, you know, forayed onto land occasionally, though it's never clear-cut because there's a fairly smooth series of fossils. There's a transition there where it's very hard to say what lived on land and what didn't. But those body fossils start appearing about 375 million years ago. So by the time we get to the Carboniferous, there's actually quite a wide array of vertebrates on land, so early tetrapods. They're the early relatives of both reptiles and amphibians, and their evolutionary relationships at the moment are still kind of up in the air. So people are arguing over which one of the Carboniferous groups is more closely related to the true amphibians, those the things we think of amphibians today, and which are more closely related to the reptiles. But around this time, you certainly have creatures which look like they could be on the branches to both of those clades, and possibly even the first true amniotes, so the first true members of the reptiles may have been around in the Carboniferous, and they were probably actually insectivores. They were probably eating Carboniferous insects for a living.
So considering how hard it is to preserve fossils in a terrestrial environment, is there a special way in which these ones in the Carboniferous are preserved?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we're looking at our earliest terrestrial ecosystems, there are a number of unique windows into the animal life of this period. So one really good example that's not Carboniferous, it's actually Devonian, is the Rhynie Chert. So this is a deposit in Scotland, which is about 413 million years old, and it represents a community of plants and animals living around some hot springs. Every now and then, they were inundated with silica-rich water that actually petrified the entire ecosystem. And if you take the rock now and you slice it into bits and have a look at it through a microscope, you can actually see really well-preserved plants and animals from this time period, purely as a result of that environment. So it's really, really lucky. And those windows are fairly rare prior to the Carboniferous. But what's really nice about the Carboniferous is that we have actually what we can best think of as a global window. So because of this paleogeography I mentioned, where you've got lots and lots of land around the equator, and also the nature of the forests at this time, and they were really low-lying, it makes ideal conditions for the preservation of terrestrial fossils. What tended to happen is that you would have changes in sea level or avulsion events, so when a river changes its course. So you would have regular inundations, and this would actually bury lots and lots of this lignin-rich wood. So there was lots and lots of carbon being buried. And also you had lots of rivers flowing in these equatorial zones into these continental shelf areas. And that meant that you had brackish water, so it wasn't quite as salty as true seawater. Both of those conditions together, having lots of carbon or carbonate from the trees and having lots of iron from the fresh water, actually lends itself towards the formation of iron carbonate nodules. So this is a mineral called siderite. And a lot of the fossils that I work on are preserved in iron carbonate. What happens is that before the rock is compacted, organisms can be buried in the sediments. So they can fall into a river, they can be washed into the sea, fall to the bottom, and as soon as they get there, they can start decaying just a tiny bit. That decay can make them a nucleation point for a nodule, so a rock that will grow out around them. And it happens before the surrounding sediments are compressed. So it actually preserves them within this rock that's growing around them in three dimensions. Over the millions of years later, they don't get squashed like the rest of the rock, but the animal inside will decay away. So what we're left with is lots and lots of fossils from this time period, which are voids, three-dimensional voids within iron carbonate nodules. And that's all because of this unique set of circumstances where you've got the equatorial land, you've got lots of rapid inundations of these low-lying carbon-rich forests. And with any one of those things, you wouldn't get preservation like this. But because they all came together in this time period, you get these wonderfully preserved fossils. And actually, this is a unique set of circumstances. This is something that isn't really happening at any place today. And it's really interesting because the Carboniferous is unique in this arrangement of continents and this situation where you had lots of these inundations. And that is why it's called the Carboniferous, because there was so much carbon preserved. And in fact, all of the coal we have pretty much globally, or the vast majority of coal reserves, are Carboniferous in age. Certainly that's true of North America, Europe, and the UK. So when we look at the Industrial Revolution, for example, and we changed the way we did manufacturing on the basis of the coal, that was only possible because all of the places where this happened have lots of coal reserves, and all of those are Carboniferous in age. So the Carboniferous has had a very large impact on human history, as well as having an impact on the world and on the geology of the world, which is really kind of neat. And it means that all of these fossil fuels that we're burning at the moment, all of this coal we're working our way through, it's going to be very hard to recreate the conditions in which that coal was created.
So during the Industrial Revolution, was there a lot of discovery of these nodules?
Yes, there were. So coal mining really kicked off in the UK, at least, in the early Victorian era. And from that point onwards, it also nicely coincided with the evolution of paleontology as a subject. So you had lots and lots of gentlemen scientists who did nothing or liked nothing better than walking around on a Sunday afternoon after church, going to spoil heaps, knocking open iron carbonate nodules, which are found associated with these coal deposits, and looking at these fossils. So there are lots and lots of specimens in museums that were collected in the Victorian era, were described maybe then or maybe not at all, which we can now come back to and have a look at using new techniques like 3D reconstruction.
So you said that the Carboniferous was really a preservational window into the past, But is it just the case that the Carboniferous, with all of its coal, is just more explored? It's had people digging for coal and finding these fossils. And so if we went back to any of the earlier terrestrial environments and dug them through just as much as we have done the Carboniferous, we might also find more fossils in those.
Yes, that is a distinct possibility. But there are elements of truth to both sides of this story, as it were. So if you look at Carboniferous fossils, it's definitely true that we've dug them more. These fossils are intimately associated with coal seams. They're usually found either in the sediments just above or just below coal seams. So it makes them ideal in terms of the collection of the fossils. However, even if we take that into account and we look at siderite nodules, a larger proportion than we might expect actually contain fossils. So this is probably because of this situation where a decaying organism provided a nucleation site for the growing nodule. And so there is an element of truth to the fact as well that this is exceptional preservation that you don't see in other time periods. So it's probably a mixture of those two. If we dug more in earlier rocks, there will probably be, we would find more terrestrial fossils from these rocks. That's almost for sure. And those would all be tied to some kind of unique window of preservation, like the Rhynie Chert. However, it would be a different one to the one we see in the Carboniferous. And the Carboniferous one is unique in that it's exceptional preservation, but it's also widespread. So it's still something special, despite the fact there is a sampling bias there.
You mentioned that not all the siderite nodules have fossils in it. So in these cases, is it that they form independently of any organisms, or is it just that the organism isn't preserved?
That is indeed the case. So you can have iron carbonate nodules forming, nucleating around something else, just some object, or even you don't necessarily need to have a nucleation point. So iron carbonate nodules will form when you've got sufficient concentrations of both the iron and the carbonate. It just so happens that having a carcass of an animal decaying provides lots and lots of bacteria and a starting point for that nodule to grow. So only about 50%, depending on the deposit, of the iron carbonate nodules will have a fossil in, and most of those aren't particularly well preserved. And all of the rest will have just formed, probably with no animal in between. It's relatively unlikely, I think, that we're getting nodules forming around animals which then no trace of remains in the nodule, because the way these things grow, it happens very rapidly. It happens within days or weeks of deposition, and they kind of seal everything inside the nodule, so it's unlikely the creature would rot away without leaving a hole, which is what we normally see. So yes, they do form without the animal to precipitate around, but a surprisingly high proportion of them do have an animal inside.
Do you get plants inside them as well?
Yes, you do. So lots and lots of plant fossils, especially seeds, are found within these nodules and often three-dimensionally preserved, as some of the animals are.
So these fossils are preserved in three dimensions within these concretions. Does that mean we have to kind of use different techniques apart from the standard, you know, pickaxe and brush or whatever to actually extract and analyse them?
Yes, we do. So one of the problems of studying three-dimensional fossils is that if you use traditional techniques, like knocking the rock open and looking at the surface that's revealed, in a three-dimensional fossil, there'll still be bits of the anatomy, such as legs, that are buried within the rock. This isn't to say that we can't use traditional approaches or that they're not good. They served us incredibly well for the last 200 years. It's just that we can now augment those with new techniques. So what I do is I use CT scanning, same as you would have in a hospital, but at higher resolution, with really powerful X-ray sources to be able to blast through the iron carbonate to actually create cross-sectional images of the fossil. From those, I can then create a computer reconstruction of the anatomy of this creature in full. So what that allows us to do is we're no longer constrained to the crack across the animal. The things like the limbs or the body or the mouth parts, which remain buried in the rock, can be extracted. We can model them in 3D, and actually getting that extra morphological information out is really, really useful. It can help us better understand the ecology of these animals, how they live their lives, also their evolutionary relationships, which in arthropods, certainly creepy crawlies, it's often built around their head or their head appendages. So getting those out can be really, really useful to us. And it can just fill in some of the gaps we've been missing in these ecosystems by looking at the fossils in three dimensions.
Are there any instances where CT scanning isn't sufficient to actually look at these fossils? Because it works on density contrasts. So are the fossils ever too close to the density of the iron siderite to actually not be visualized?
Yeah, there are far more situations where I would like where CT scanning doesn't work. So for one, naturally, you have to have a three-dimensional fossil. If it's two-dimensional, CT scanning won't show you much new. As you say, if the fossil and the rock are about the same density, it depends on the energy of the X-rays you use, actually, whether the map you get out of the cross-section is based on the density or the atomic number of the elements. But there are many examples where both of those two are so similar that you can't really tell the fossil from the matrix. So one example of that is the Herefordshire Lagerstätte, this Silurian deposit where you've got calcium carbonate fossils in a calcium carbonate cement, where you can see their cross-sections because they're different colours, but they've got the same composition and the same density, so CT scanning just doesn't help. So in fossils like that, it's very, very difficult to get scans out. And that's not so much a problem with iron carbonate fossils, because there's a massive density difference between air and iron carbonate. The problem we have with iron carbonate nodules is that iron is very, very dense to X-rays. It's about one of the worst metals to try and blast your way through with X-rays. So you have to both have an incredibly powerful X-ray source, the kind of thing you seriously don't want to stand in front of because it would be quite dangerous, but also you've got to have a lot of time. So you've got to be able to spend maybe, in some cases, 5 or 10 minutes blasting something with X-rays to get enough through to be able to then get a decent X-ray out of the back. However, that lends itself to its own problems, or leads to its own problems, in that it will saturate the detector panel in the CT scanner, so everything will appear as washed out and white. So we do have problems with the largest iron carbonate nodules. And then finally, in iron carbonate nodules and all fossils, even if they're 3D, it doesn't necessarily mean they're going to scan that well. Sometimes they're preserved well in 3D. There is a density difference, but you only get thin bits, for example, that are preserved. So you may have a creature where the only bits that are hollow are less than 10 microns or so, and then you can't actually get that detail out of the CT scan. So there are many, many situations in which CT scanning doesn't work. And I find that of my CT scans of these fossils, these iron carbonate fossils, about 80% won't be good enough to work on.
What do you do in instances where, you mentioned the Herefordshire Lagerstätte. What do you do in instances where you've got where the density contrast isn't big enough to actually use CT scanning? What techniques do you use then to extract the fossils or to digitise them?
I personally don't do anything. I let other people do that kind of work. It's incredibly time consuming. So in that situation, what you have to do is you have to grind away the fossil. Using special grinding apparatus, you can grind it away about 20 or 30 microns, so that's 20 or 30 one-thousandths of a millimeter at a time. And each interval, you can stop, you can clean it, and then you can take a digital photograph. And after that, you can do exactly the same process as you do with CT scanning to create a 3D model. So what you do in both CT scanning and serial grinding is you pick out the bits you want to see in 3D, normally using some kind of rule. So in my CT scan fossils, the fossil, which is air, will often appear as black or dark, and the iron carbonate will appear as white. So what I do to create a 3D model is I say that every pixel that's dark is probably fossil, and I want to see in three dimensions, and everything that's white is the iron carbonate, and I should ignore. And that allows me to create a rough three-dimensional fossil or three-dimensional computer model of the fossil. However, I've still got problems there because there's normally air outside the nodule. There's normally a crack across the nodule along which it was originally split to see the fossil, and there's often debris in there, little bits of plant and stuff. So after that, you have to go through every single slice, colouring in different bits of the anatomy, allowing them to be rendered separately. And by doing that, you can remove all of the different bits and hopefully get a nice, neat, three-dimensional reconstruction of the fossil out at the other end.
It sounds like serial grinding is a bit of a destructive technique. So this actually destroys the fossil in the process.
It does, yes, which is one of its major I guess, weaknesses is fossils are often very rare and destroying them is often frowned upon. So that's traditionally a bit of a problem. And that's why we're constantly working to come up with new X-ray techniques that can non-destructively scan fossils. So, for example, all of this work with iron carbonate nodules is completely non-destructive. You just shove them in a CT scanner, they come out exactly as they were before. There are ways you can look at not just the X-ray attenuation, so the amount X-rays are absorbed, for want of a better term, by the material, but actually look at how it affects the wavelength of the X-rays, and that's a thing called phase contrast. So experimenting with techniques like that can allow us to hopefully try and get to these really difficult fossils which don't work with traditional CT, but still be able to look at them without destroying them.
So what kind of animals do we find in these siderite nodules?
We find a large range of different animals. In fact, by the Carboniferous, you've got lots of the major groups of animals around. So during this time, you've got vertebrates. Normally, those were, I guess, a bit big, and they don't generally tend to be preserved in nodules, which tend to preserve things slightly smaller. So most of the fossils of early tetrapods from the Carboniferous are usually in shales rather than in these nodules, though there are some examples of early hagfish, for example, which are preserved in three dimensions in nodules. But what you normally get in nodules are small invertebrates, so lovely creepy crawlies, especially terrestrial arthropods. And I think that these are well worth looking at, because actually, if you look at the diversity of life, the vast majority of living organisms of all kinds of creatures, plants, bacteria, everything, the vast majority of those fall into two main lineages. At least 75% of living organisms are insects, and a large portion of the others are members of the arachnids. So they're either mites or ticks, which are an incredibly diverse group. So in the Carboniferous, we've got these two lineages, which are both coming into their modern forms. They're somewhere near the shortly after the origin of insects, quite a while after the origin of arachnids, but still early enough that we see some unique features of their anatomy that can give us clues about their origins and how they evolved. So it's really nice that they preserve in these nodules, because it's a unique insight into these two biggest groups of animals at a time when they were still in a fairly primitive form. But also you get a lot of marine animals in these. So when you get terrestrial animals preserved, if it's a lake deposit, then a lot of the animals will be terrestrial, but they could also be freshwater species. In marine environments where you get these nodules or kind of continental shelf type deposits, a lot of the animals will be those that live in the sea rather than those that have been washed in from land.
So I first came across your work when you were doing a bit on trigonotarbids. Could you tell us what they are?
Yeah, the trigonotarbids are a group of arachnids. They're now extinct. They went extinct in the Permian period, so shortly after the time period we're looking at now. There should be a picture of these guys on the website, and they look a lot like spiders, except unlike spiders, they don't have a narrow junction between the front and the back half of their body. And also the back half of their body, the abdomen, still has segments, which you can see, which is something that all but the most primitive spiders have completely lost. And they're a member of a group called the tetrapulmonates. So they're related to spiders, whip scorpions, camel spiders, and I think one or two other groups. But they're probably more primitive than those, we think, at the moment. Although we're actually lacking a cladistic, so a computer-based placement of these creatures at the moment. But what I've done is I've scanned a few of these, and often they'll have their limbs buried within the rock. And especially in these guys, their limbs are quite important. And I managed to get the mouth parts and the end of the limbs out from a few of these creatures, and also a far better picture of their three-dimensional morphology, so how they look. And what this showed is that there's one group, the picture on the website, which doesn't have spines. It's a member of a group called the Anthracomatidae. And what was really neat about this one is because we could see the limbs, because of the CT scanning, we could see that they were actually rotated slightly around so they could be held in front of the creature. This is something we call a laterograde stance, which we see in modern-day crab spiders. Now, crab spiders are those often bright yellow or brightly coloured spiders which sit on the edge of a plant, waiting for insects to fly by and try and pollinate it, and then grab them with modified forelimbs, very much like the ones we see in this member of the trigonotarbids. So that allowed us to say that this Carboniferous trigonotarbid may well have been an ambush predator like those guys. The other trigonotarbid on the website is a really spiny one, And that's probably a defensive adaptation. So we think Trinitarbids were actually the first terrestrial predators. They were the first creatures on land eating other animals, and thus they were top dog of the food chain. However, by this period, they were no longer the kings of their realm. They were actually early, as we said, early reptiles, or at least early tetrapods there, which had nice sharp teeth, which are really good at crushing Trinitarbids. And we think the reason this creature has all of these spines is as a defensive adaptation. And what's really neat about having those two together is that tells us something. So back in the Devonian period, where we get the first fossils of this group, they're fairly simple in morphology. They don't have any of these spines, and also they don't really have these rotated limbs. However, if you fast forward a few tens of million years to when they're being preyed upon by these early amphibians or tetrapods, they're both changing. One has changed its mode of life to ambush predation, so it can spend most of its time hiding, avoiding possible predators. And the other one has developed spines, so it's less likely to be eaten. So you're actually building a picture of a group that's under increasing ecological stress because something is preying on it. And I don't think it's a coincidence that they went extinct 10 or 20 million years after these fossils were found.
So they're not the only group of arachnids, though, are they?
No. So during this time period, you get scorpions, and you get also members of a group called the Apiliones that we otherwise known as harvestmen. Those are the creatures which have a really tiny body. Again, unlike spiders, they don't have a narrow bit between the front and the back half of their body. And they often have incredibly long legs, and the body hangs down between them. So those are the creatures you see around harvest time, often in Western Europe and in the US. And they're called daddy long legs in America, but aren't crane flies. So they're not the flying insects that we call daddy long legs in the UK. And I was lucky enough to describe some fossils, some fossil Apilionids from 305 million years ago from a deposit in France. So these harvestmen, they're a really neat group to work on. So there are about 6,400 described species. They're a very, very diverse group. For rough comparison, there are about 5,700 described species of mammals. So we're talking about a group that's very diverse, more so than mammals, but there are only six or seven fossils older than 50 million years, because they tend to live in terrestrial environments, and they have a soft exoskeleton which rots away very easily. So they have very poor preservation potential. So to find two new fossils of these guys was absolutely fantastic. It was an incredible privilege because they're so rare. And I found when I CT scanned these, I had no idea what they were. They were just blobs in the rock from what I could see. When I CT scanned them, lovely creatures came out. There should be some pictures on the website. There was one with nice long legs and a small body that hangs down in between those legs. And there's another really spiny one with the nose-like projection at the front. The legs aren't as well preserved in that one, but it has deep pits on its exoskeleton, suggesting it was a bit better built than the other one, which is slightly crushed. And this was really neat because not only do we have relatively few fossil harvestmen, they're generally not very well preserved. So before this point, we've never been able to do a cladistic analysis or a computer analysis of their evolutionary relationships. However, these guys were complete enough to allow us to plug them in to a morphological matrix of living Apilionids, of living harvestmen. And that was really neat because that actually brought them out as members of extant subgroups. So the harvestmen, as we know them now, extant ones, are split into four suborders. And by doing this cladistic analysis, we found out that these two fossils from France were both members of living extant lineages, and those are the latest branching Apilionid lineages. So what's really neat about that is we can say that all of the major groups of harvestmen were around in the Carboniferous period by 305 million years ago, at a point where most other animals were still in their primitive, or as we would say as paleontologists, their stem group form. So it appears harvestmen are amongst the earliest branching arachnids. We kind of always suspected that, because unlike the rest of arachnids, they eat solid food. The other arachnids tend to vomit digestive enzymes on their prey and then suck up liquid food, which isn't what we see in the harvestmen, and we think is probably the primitive state for arachnids as a whole. But as well as being early branching, we think they're a really good example of evolutionary stasis. They seem not to have changed a great deal in the last 305 million years.
And are there many insects about?
There are indeed a lot of insects around in the Carboniferous. And in fact, the earliest body fossils we have of insects late from the late Carboniferous. So the insects are, as I mentioned, a really important group. But we're kind of stuck in that we've got two fossils from the Rhynie Chert, so that's 413 million years old, one of which is a pair of mandibles, so the mouth parts, which look like they could be from a group of winged insects. However, we don't have any fossils of winged insects until the Carboniferous. So at the beginning of the Carboniferous period, where we start getting this preservation with siderite nodules, lots and lots of insect groups suddenly appear. You have things like dragonflies and their early relatives, and some bizarre creatures which actually have six wings, or at least they've got four wings like dragonflies do, but they have a pair of winglets on the front segment of their thorax, which is something we don't see in any modern group, and is a tantalizing glimpse of what could be the origin of insect wings, but we can't really work out what they were there for, so they don't really help us. And in this late Carboniferous, after a long period of having no fossils, suddenly all of these groups appear, and there's already been a lot of diversification within the insects. However, there's one group that's particularly successful, we think, during the time period, and that's the cockroaches, or more accurately, the cockroachoid insects. Carboniferous is often known as the age of the cockroaches because there are so many of these guys around. And they're cockroachoid rather than cockroaches because they actually predate the split between the cockroaches and the praying mantises, which are sister group to those guys. And the cockroaches are, in fact, not a true biological grouping because termites are highly derived eusocial cockroaches. So we've got a lot of fossils that look a lot like modern cockroaches, but don't quite tick all the boxes of what makes a modern cockroach a cockroach. And I was lucky enough to work on one of these. And it's a nice creature with some really well-preserved wings. It's got a head shield like a lot of cockroaches, or in fact all cockroaches do. And it's got a small head just protruding out the front there. And in front of that, there are some antennae sticking out. And those aren't completely preserved, so there are only about 10 segments in them. But they were probably very long, much like modern cockroaches. The reason I did the CT scan on this fossil was because I wanted to see if there was a way we could get the limbs out of the nodule. All work to date on fossil insect relationships has been based upon the wing venation. So you look at the veins in the wings and you use those to work out the relationships between different groups. However, this is slightly problematic because it can vary between the left and the right wing on a single individual. And we have major arguments about how the wings are related to each other in different groups. So my idea behind scanning this was if I could get the limbs out, I could then try and build up a picture of their evolution relationships based on not just the wing venation, but also the limbs, the mouth parts, the antennae, the genitals, the body, and lots of bits like that to try and get a clearer picture of the relationships between these different groups. Because there are so many roachoid insects in the Carboniferous, I chose those to study. And as you can see from the picture on the website, there were lots and lots of nice details there. So clearly, it is going to be possible to try and use these fossils to unravel some of those questions about insect relationships. And that's what I'm going to be spending the next 3 years doing. However, just getting the limbs out could actually tell us a lot more about this creature. So the limbs are fairly long, they get longer towards the back, and they're held at a low angle to the body. That's a specialization in modern cockroaches that make them, per unit weight, the fastest creatures in the animal kingdom. So you can say, as a result of the morphology of the limbs, of their appearance, that this creature was a fast runner. At the end of the limbs, it has both claws and small adhesive pads we see in modern cockroaches called euplanchulae. Now, those claws are used by modern cockroaches for climbing rough plant surfaces like tree bark. And the adhesive pads are lost in cockroaches which don't spend some of their time in the canopy, you know, either perching or laying eggs or looking for food. So the adhesive pads are an adaptation towards climbing smooth plant surfaces. And because this creature still has those, we can say that it probably spent some of its time climbing. So as a result of that better detail on the limbs, we can say that it was both a rapid runner and a fairly adept climber. Looking at its mouth parts, we can also say that it has a fairly simple arrangement of teeth. The arrangement of teeth is a lot like we see in modern forest-dwelling cockroaches that eat decaying matter on the forest floor. So that's a fairly decent guess of what this creature may have eaten. So as well as being able to say something hopefully down the line about the evolutionary relationships between the insects, we can use individual fossils to try and build up a clearer picture of how each group was living its life and how they may have interacted with each other.
You had a paper out recently with Imran Rahman about using these digital fossils as a tool for communicating paleontology to the public. Can you tell us a little bit about your experiences with them and how it differed from just using normal fossils?
Yeah, that was fun, actually. So what we did was we thought it would be really good to try and actually print some of these fossils out in 3D. Because one of the problems doing public engagement with actual fossils is sometimes if they're particularly rare, you can't allow people to touch them. And one of the best ways of exploring these fossils is to pick them up and have a proper look at them. And also, obviously, if there are issues, for example, if someone is blind, they can't actually see a fossil. And it's by printing them out in 3D, it allows you to both let everyone, and no matter what their circumstances, explore the fossil in lots of different ways, by either looking at it, by feeling it, by actually getting a picture of what it's like in your hand. But also it allows you to blow the fossil up. Allows you to make it a lot bigger. So you don't have an explosion, you just make it bigger. You get this unique circumstance where people who may not be able to see images of microscopic organisms, for example, could actually get an idea of what they're like through touch. So we thought it would be a really awesome idea. We looked into 3D printing, we found someone who could do some 3D printing with us, and we got a few of these fossils printed out. And it was really, really good. So we took them to a museum, we laid them on a table with some 3D models for people to play with, and then actually used the fossils, the 3D printed fossils, to talk about the mode of life of the creatures, maybe their evolutionary relationships, and just about a whole range of different issues, depending on which fossil we were looking at. And it was both really successful and really good fun. So that was both really valuable as a scientific tool, but also it made the fossils far more approachable to pick them out without worrying about damaging them. And one thing I've discovered from the experience is that if you give a 2-year-old one of these fossils, they'll just love to smash them against whatever. So it was both an interesting and an expensive endeavor, but it was really, really good fun.
Light PaleoCast.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with John Tennant and Joe Keating. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association. Music was supplied by The Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at PaleoCast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.
One that is actually quite important, but you don't tend to think of much, is reproduction. So often in the sea, animals will spawn. They'll just release eggs and sperm. They'll combine. Are you giggling, Dave? Really?
Dave, are you kidding? I'm sat here thinking about the biology and...
I'm giggling.
I was just thinking about how much it's like life in Leicester. If you go clubbing, that's pretty much what happens.
Nice. So with the exception of the life in Leicester, generally you can't spawn as a land animal. So what you have to do is you have to think... Yeah, so another thing we don't really think about, but is quite important to land animals, is reproduction. So for organisms living in the sea, they'll often spawn. They'll just release sperm and eggs into the water. Those two will combine. Oh, man. Yeah, so those two will combine and then we'll have babies falling around all over the place. However, if you're living on land, you're making this really difficult, guys. I'm going to talk about penises now. This will be awesome. And then there's also a carboniferous penis, which I've just discovered on a fossil, which is very, very exciting and is... It's absolutely wonderful. So you'll be hearing about that in the near future, I'm sure.
I just want to point out that we haven't actually scripted this, and yet you're still able to rattle off the exact ages and where all of these penises are found, as if you've memorized it.
This is science, man.
It's a bit suspicious, isn't it? But honestly, I don't really spend all of my time studying the origin of penises. Though... When I was working on my penis that I just discovered in my pleonid, lovely, lovely penis. I did find out there was actually a book about the evolution of copulatory organs, so that's on the reading list. That's going to be my birthday present.
Fantastic. Dave, you best not edit any of this stuff out.
We'll see. you mentioned the ostracod penis. Don't they have hemipenes, which is kind of like a double penis?
I don't actually know.
I thought they did, but maybe that's...
I'm drawing a blank there, but I can always Google ostracod penis and see what happens.
Let's see.
I think maybe we should put a picture of it up in the
unlike an ostracod
on the webpage.
Ostracods do also have giant sperm, I think.
Yeah, I think I remember it being even longer than the body. Have I made that up?
No, I think that's cnidarians. That's barnacles, because they have to obviously reach other barnacles in order to have sex.
Yeah,
I think
40 times the body length, aren't they? According to the recent wild sex with Karen Bonda.
Yeah, so I don't think ostracods are that long. They're just kind of long. But they're sperm and giant, I think.
Yeah. Wow.
Okay.
Have you guys seen the Wild Sex series yet? It's worth checking out.
No, I haven't. I'm sorry, guys. My internet just died on my other computer. So I was actually looking that up as we were talking, but it's kind of died.
All right. No worries. Show us.
No, I want the answer, really, to be honest. So, you know, otherwise, I'm not really going to look it up. I'm on Imperial's virtual VPN as well, so hopefully they won't chuck me off.
That's fine. I've searched for worse things.
Yeah. Oh, look. I found a thing called Hung Like an Ostracod.
Yeah, that's got mentions David Sevater in it as well.
Oh, good. So yeah. In fact, that's pretty much that's it when it comes to ostracod penises online. Right, should we carry on then?
Mm-hmm. Right, where were we?
We just talked about penises.